Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Thoughtful Thursday is our expert day. It's the day when you and I have the opportunity to meet an expert who gives us lots of information that we can sort of put into our hat and use in a regular on a regular basis. I'm very pleased to introduce you to today's guest, who is described as an award-winning teacher. So we'll have to find out what that's all about. Douglas Haddad is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Raising Teens and Tweens, Strategies for Unlocking Your Child's Full Potential. Douglas, welcome to Mind Talk.
Dr. Brewer, thank you for having me.
Now, I must say, an award-winning middle school teacher, I know that there are people listening who are going, how did he manage that? I am so impressed. You are also a best-selling author. You're a parenting and an education expert. You do all kinds of things. Tell us a little bit about Douglas Haddad.
All right. Yeah. Well, as you said, I'm a full-time middle school science teacher, and this year I've been privileged to be recognized as my district's Teacher of the Year. And there's about 100 of us in the state of Connecticut then that vie for the Connecticut State Teacher of the Year. And I end up making it all the way to the finals, and I was coined a Connecticut Teacher Ambassador in Public Education. So I was also recognized with that award. So it's really been an outstanding year. I've had an opportunity to speak with educators across the state, get a chance to go into different people's classrooms, be on different councils to really get a good understanding of what's going on in other districts, what are the needs that we're trying to fill here in education. So it's been great, and I'm looking forward to, we have an upcoming event at Mohegan Sun, which is sort of the big Teacher of the Year convention called Empowered to Lead Symposium. So that's a two-day conference, and then next year I'm going to have an NSTA, probably a national conference to go to in science. So one thing after another, I'm really getting a great opportunity to expand myself as an educator and better connect with the children.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. You've actually been doing this for 17 or so years. And as I understand it, you work with children from all kinds of different backgrounds and abilities. And that's often difficult for folks. They may be really expert at working with, let's say, you know, 10-year-olds who fit this particular bracket, but not so much 12-year-olds who fit that particular bracket or have, you know, different abilities. How do you manage to do all of that?
Well, it's interesting because my first year coming in, I'll never forget this. I had a student in my classroom who had real social and emotional needs. I mean, this is an individual who, really would hear voices in his head, and he would try to get rid of those voices by hitting his head against a wall. While in the same class, I had somebody who was subjected to a wheelchair, and he was really in fragile condition. And in my classroom, at the middle school level, we don't have different levels. So all the students are sort of heterogeneously mixed, which means we get kids from all different backgrounds. I have students I teach in the same classroom with autism, with it could be anything, Down syndrome. I have kids with social emotional needs, ADHD. I have students that are high flyers in there, kids that want to be under the radar, motivated, unmotivated. So you really learn over the years how to tailor to their needs. And how I did it was just trying to connect at really a human level with them. That's really I learned what kids want. They want them to know that you care about them. And then everything else opens up. And once you make that connection, you're able to sort of spark the fire in them. And then over the years, as time went on, I took my passion of music and I said, how can I use this to help all students learn at really their own pace? I really wanted to meet a learner where they were at. I learned I can't get everybody, you know, from point A to point Z at the same time. So my way of doing it was, let's make some music here. And I wrote all these songs. I made music videos because on the side I have my own album of music that I released. So I said, you know, let me take that. And I know music's sort of a universal way of learning. And then students could watch these videos at any time. They could watch it before the unit, during the unit as reinforcement, or at sort of the tail end of the unit when we're going to take the exam. And I've really noticed an increase in motivation, increase in grades. Kids are performing these songs in my class. You know, I ask them, if anybody wants to perform for bonus points, you're more than welcome. and they've dressed up. It's amazing what's happening, and that's sort of my way of taking a lot of my passions with the arts and, you know, acting and music, and really incorporating that into learning and seeing a big turnaround.
You know, your excitement and your passion is almost infectious. I mean, I can sort of feel myself smiling as you're describing all these different, what an amazing experience for these different children who have different experiences to have a sense of belonging and creativity all together. That just sounds extraordinary. What a gift you have.
Oh, thanks a lot. Well, that's what it's all about. It's tapping into a student where they're at and really tapping into their multiple intelligences. And that's another thing I can say early on. You really, as a teacher, you learn that. You learn that every student isn't just going to learn based on you telling them something. I mean, some kids will. Some kids are audio learners. They can, with their ears. And then other kids, more visual learners. And then other kids still won't get it until they actually touch it, more of a tactile approach. And then there's kids, you know, that aren't really hands-on people, but they're more, they got to get out of their seat. They're more bodily kinesthetic. So what Howard Gardner proposed years ago with the multiple intelligences theory really does apply to these students. And once we find what works for them, that's what I try to tap into. For example, in this last quarter of the year right now, kids have the option in a human body project where they're trying to find out what's the purpose of a human body system. What are the different parts? What are the functions? And what's a related infectious disease or a genetic disorder that can affect that body system? So kids have the opportunity now to make their own music video. So they're working together in groups. Some kids are putting together the beats. They're using GarageBand, using all these different programs. Other kids are lyricist writers, so they're very good in that way. Other students are more so looking at the research component of it. So it's a collaborative approach. We're getting all kids from all unique learning styles working together. Some kids are more motivated at one thing than another, but they all work together because they're trying to accomplish a common goal. And I think that's where I see, even in science, this next generation approach is we're really looking at it from that perspective. What's the big problem you're trying to solve? How to engage them in learning and see that that's meaningful and real world to them and to society. And then going from there and creating a product, designing it, seeing if it's working, and if it's not, going back and redesigning, retesting, and then going through and argumenting why. Why is my approach successful? And then each group does that, and then you're able to learn a little bit from each group, and it's a nice way for learning to take place. It keeps everybody accountable, keeps everybody engaged and interested in the topics. And and then the second, just to say one other thing, Dr. Brewer, the second other option for this project, in addition to the music video, some kids may say, well, Mr. Hatt, you know, I like your music. It's great. It gets me involved. But I'm not a music person. I don't know how to play instruments. I can't sing to save my life. And I say, okay, fine. So then the other option is that they can create this sort of case of the mystery blank, where they create their own story behind. It could be the case of the undercooked burger and what caused this person to get sick during a Memorial Day picnic. And then they go through and they have to research all the potential diseases out there. So, you know, maybe it could be something the kids learn. Oh, is it UTI, is it urinary tract infection? Or is it salmonella poisoning? Or is it E. coli? And then they go through and they sort of carve their own way. It's like choose your own path. So kids are doing amazing things using all their different things. I think it's a lot more interesting than just doing, you know, an old-fashioned book report on a topic. It's really getting them to think and getting the whole class involved in what's going on. I mean, I'm really excited about it.
You've almost got me wanting to go back to middle school, and I didn't think that would ever happen.
Oh, come on back. I got room for you.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Definitely.
Now, I mean, these sound like projects for older children. When you talk about teens and tweens, what age range are we talking about?
So we're talking typically, when we talk about teens, that's obvious there, the teenage range from 13 and 19. So really looking at the start of adolescence and all the way through leading up to going into the college years and upon high school graduation. The tweens, meaning sort of between childhood and teenhood, so that would range anywhere, some scientists and researchers say, as early as 8 years old, usually about 9, 10, 11, when we start to see some of the maturational and different physical changes take place.
So we're talking potentially about children who range in age from 8 years old to 19 years old. That's a range. Yeah. That's a huge range.
Oh, it is. It is. And they change drastically. I mean, even the parents I've spoken with over the years, they say, what happened to my child? I don't even know who he or she is. And I said, just wait, just be patient. And in my book, too, I talk about different, you know, what I call child unlimited principles to apply to get them through, and not just get them through, but also thrive during this time of tween. And then as they get more into, you know, more serious challenges that take place and more pressures into high school, also thriving in those years.
Well, speaking of your book, you say early on that we're in the midst of a kid crisis. So what do you mean by that? Because what we've just talked about sounds really exciting and wonderful, and you've got the children engaged, and it's great. So what's the crisis?
Well, what ends up happening as a child gets older, you know, there's a variety of different challenges that become more and more, I don't know how I should say it, it's like paramount in their life. You know, I teach children at middle school level. I've coached kids at the high school level. I've mentored kids middle school and high school level. So I've seen that as they get older, then all of a sudden now the changes are more into, as they get into the teenhood, more so with their peer groups, with relationships. All right. So now they're not necessarily thinking so much about the academics. So that's why I try to do everything in my power to make things very creative, make my environment very safe for kids, and make them very interested in and buy into the academic piece. Because let's face it, a lot of kids come in, they got their own issues going on at home. They may not be coming in with a breakfast in their belly. They may be coming from a family that is either neglectful in that way of abuse, or physically and mentally abusive. There might be addictions going on at home, all kinds of issues. So that's really, you know, in my book, I talk about how to provide really a loving, positive, supporting way that strengthens a child's overall self-worth, value, and well-being. And it's easier when they're younger, and that's why in my book I say if you apply these principles early on, then it becomes that much easier when the problems get harder. So part one talks about the child unlimited principles, and then my second part of the book delves into the child limiting challenges that parents should be aware of and how to prevent and intervene before it's too late.
Well, let's talk just for a moment about teachers, because you don't come to the profession because you're interested in making $1 billion a minute.
No.
You come to the profession because you care about children, you care about teaching, you care about learning. But I've talked to so many teachers over the years who are feeling burned out between teaching to the test and overcrowded classrooms and all of the social issues, as you described, that, and more, that children can come into the classroom with. How do you navigate all of that and not get burned out yourself?
Well, I really look at it this way. I say we all come in at one point in our life to the real world, whether we come right out of high school or whether we come out of college or we just have an epiphany moment saying, you know, I want to matter in life. I want to make a big difference. And some people say, I want to change the world. Well, I think the biggest way you can change the world is one child's life at a time. And that's really been my mission since day one. I mean, I could talk to you right now and tell you that, you know, I enjoy going to work each day and educating the kids that I teach and, you know, helping them reinforce good character and helping them gain confidence in themselves and all that. I mean, and really, that's what I've done. I've helped kids set and achieve their goals. I've helped them persevere through challenge to rise up to achieve their dreams. However, Dr. Brewer, I would really be lying to you if I said that this was easy work. And I can understand how if teachers aren't supported by administrators, if they're not working with colleagues that have that same goal in mind, that same mission, then it's going to be tough because you do have students who come into school. They're unmotivated to learn. They're anxious to confront their peers. Many of them flat out, they're so unmotivated that they have unruly behavior. They make a lot of poor choices. And if you don't have the support of the administration or the parents, it becomes a vicious circle, and you're trapped in that. You want the best. Every teacher wants the best. There's no doubt about that. But kids today are coming in with so many more issues. I mean, I see more kids suffering from anxiety, kids trying to figure out their sexuality. These are things that weren't even out, you know, in the open back, you know, let alone a decade, two, three ago.
It's true.
Kids are more depressed. more mental health conditions. So we still see kids experimenting with substance abuse and all these poor choices. So I think what I'm trying to say here, well, I know what I'm trying to say, is that teachers nowadays aren't just these people that stand up in front of the room and detach themselves from the kids and just give information as a one-way street. This is how it's done. We are so connected in with the children that it's an emotional investment. I mean, we're their counselor, we're their big brother, big sister, mother, father, teacher, coach, everything. And that's where we might be feeling the burnout as a whole.
It really does sound like, in at least in your school, and I know there are other schools like that as well, where just as a faculty, you kind of come to work and you're happy to be there and you're interested in the students. And that absolutely reflects back from the students. It has to.
It does. It's you know what I said? It's funny. At the convocation, the teacher of the year convocation, I had to give a speech this year, and I used a reference to the triangle. As the reason why, why I was hired. And I sang a song, and it was called Hired to Inspire. And I talked about the triangle because the triangle represents the making of the unlimited and complete child. And I actually sing a little verse in there, and I say, remember the triangle, the power of three, because it's about teachers, parents, and the community. So it's an interconnection between what the parents do, what the teachers do, and what the community gives for service and messages to the child, and how we all interconnect. And without powerful connections in there, as we know, with any building or structure, it's going to collapse. So that's why I say that the triangle really represents the unlimited child, and it's all about really leaving a lasting legacy one child at a time. And it's not just us as teachers. It's parents, it's the community, it's people in the media, whether it be political figures, whether it be musicians, actors, whether it be psychologists, psychiatrists, law enforcement. Everybody is a role model, because that's the thing. A child is watching what everybody's doing. They're taking in that information, and they're making it their own, and they're justifying behaviors, especially for parents. Parents really, that right at the forefront, they're the primary influence of a child, especially early on in life, to help them make sagacious decisions as they go through. And really, that's what my book's all about. And I really wanted to give back. That was my big thing. That's my way of saying we can't give up on kids. We can't give up on our future. And we really can't give up on ourselves as caretakers of a child's overall mental, social, emotional, and physical well-being.
So what many would call the old school do as I say, not as I do theory, it flat out doesn't work at all.
It's a temporary approach. It's more of a fear-based approach. And in the long run, it's not teaching children to make wise decisions for themselves. It's not teaching them to take accountability for their actions. It's not allowing them to make the mistakes to grow as a person. That's more of an authoritarian approach. The best, most effective means of parenting, according to research, is authoritative approach, where you still have a firm position. You show that this is the rules, but here are the consequences based on the choices that you're going to make. So there's an equal amount of what they call parental demandingness, meaning expectations from the parent, and also an equal amount of responsiveness. So listening to a child, not just telling them what to do, this is it, I don't want to hear your side, but also taking into account that and discussing different situations in an open communication forum.
Which, for some folks on the face of it sounds like a lot more work. But on the other hand, what you're actually doing is you're building a lot healthier child and relationship. Doug, we're going to take a break in just a moment. When we return, folks, we will continue the conversation with Douglas Haddad, who is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Raising Teens and Tweens, Strategies for Unlocking Your Child's Full Potential. And Douglas, when we return, you tell us to forget the three R's and talk about the three S's. That's where we're going to pick up. Folks, we'll be right back. Stay where you are. Douglas, you say forget the three R's, focus on the three S's. What are the three S's?
Well, first off, I don't want to get English teachers and math teachers too angry at me when I say forget the three R's. But really, I'm shifting the focus more so than the academic rigor that we always are looking at. And I know that's been the big thing, that's the accountability measure been for teachers for a while and for administrators. What are the scores? What are the indexes? Are we improving? Is that going to help us with, you know, funding and budgetary issues, all that? I know that's always a big concern, but I say we really want to shift the focus away from just academics and looking at the three S's. And what the three S's are, Dr. Brewer, are you want to raise a child to unlock their full potential and achieve being smart, successful, and self-disciplined. Those are the three S's.
Now, with each of those, smart, successful, and self-disciplined, that can mean so many different things to so many different people. And as you have described working with children of varying capabilities, how do you help them understand that smart for Sally may be a different smart for Sue?
Yes, that's where doing a variety of different activities, as I said, really tapping into the different abilities and intelligences. I think you're exactly right. I mean, some children are out there, they can answer a math problem like a whiz kid, and other kids don't get good grades, and they just feel, you know, I always hear, oh, I'm stupid, I'm dumb, I can't do this. And that has a lasting effect on how a child thinks and what their self-confidence is, and that really, you know, hinders them from doing activities in the future and taking those choices and taking those chances as well. So really, I tell the kids, you can't be great at everything. You want to recognize what your interests are, but don't be afraid to recognize where you struggle a little bit, and we're going to work to build that. So I tell them, don't be afraid of it. We all have strengths and weaknesses, but one of my jobs as a teacher is to provide students with opportunities to help them discover their own interests and talents. And, you know, and I do that by really within a unit, I'll try to tap into every single thing. I love to incorporate the creative arts. Big into that with, like I said, the music, acting. We did a unit on the cell, and versus having the kids just simply draw out the cell and label the parts and color it, I did do that because I know kids are some kids are very artistic and can best connect that way. Others said, oh, I can't draw to save my life, Mr. Haddad. I said, well, welcome to the club. I'm the president of the Artistically Challenged Club. I said, you want to be the VP? So I make a little joke with them to make them put them at ease. And then when it gets to another project where each kid then can be responsible in the making of an overall in-class play, now they're, again, working in groups. So one kid might be strong in understanding sort of the visual aspect of maybe almost like the graphic designer. And nowadays you can use the Google tools and you can literally on the paper, you can map out the whole classroom and where you want to position this for scene one and where this goes for scene two and what characters for scene three. So we got one kid into that. Another kid would be the script writer. So they're very good at dialogue. Another kid would be excellent at writing the overall summary, like the plot of it, the conflict, looking at the intro, rising action, climax, falling action, and a resolution like it would in English class. And then another kid would be good for seeing the costume designs. And then another kid might be good as an overall leader, keeping everybody on task, more of a managerial role. So I really try to hit upon a lot of different things that kids can do, let them decide how they're going to work together on it, and then really come up with a great finished product. And that's really what it's all about. When you're working in isolation, I mean, some kids, yes, they're more introverted in nature. They would probably prefer to go up in their cocoon or, you know, in their shell. But we have to also explore that there's other means to do things. And sometimes it's a little bit uncomfortable, but it's about really trying to feel comfortable in the uncomfortable, if that makes any sense. And that's what I try to let kids experience.
Do you ever get any pushback from parents who have their own view of what it means for their child to be successful versus the child's actual abilities to be successful in areas that the parents may or may not approve of, understand, you name it?
Oh, yes. I mean, from time to time, you know, there'll be some parents who certainly they have a vision of what they see for their child. I mean, certainly they should know their child the best. And what I say to them is I say, you know, what's important is school's a time where a child is going to explore many different avenues, and let's see what they can do. And one of the avenues is, and for better or for worse, working in partnerships or working in groups. So, you know, and again, parents are aware and sometimes more aware than I am of their child when it comes to working in groups. And they say, oh, well, last time, you know, Johnny worked in a group, he got stuck with all the work, or last time this happened, they got a bad grade because of this. And so I think it lends an opportunity for parents to sort of let off the gas pedal and ease up a little bit and not have to worry about the outcome so much. And that's really where I take a role as a facilitator in their child's overall education, is I say, well, if a child has to step up a little bit, what should they do? Is that your problem, mom or dad? They're like, well, no, not really. Right. So then they can talk with me. They can talk with the teacher. They can talk with the other child. We can have a conversation. So again, it puts the onus on the child, gets more leadership skills going, and also allows the child to make choices and have natural consequences. And ultimately, that's what happens. It's not, you know, about falling down or failing. It's really about how many times you get back up and what you learn from it. And I think middle school time, for what I teach, is the perfect time for that to happen, because when they get to high school, they realize that their actions really do have a consequence or a reward attached to it. And the parents are, I think, more appreciative of that, and they don't have to handhold their child all the way up to graduation day.
Well, speaking of handholding their child, I would suggest that, you know, there are some parents who do this all the way through the child's education. Some parents maybe cut it off at college, who knows. But the notion that if the child has homework, then it's the parent's job to see that it gets done, and it gets done, quote unquote, correctly. What do you say to that?
I would have to disagree. What I always recommend to parents out there is I say, check that your child has done the homework and has completed it, and that's really about it. I certainly understand at an elementary level, yes, there is going to be more hand-holding, more say, did check this out again. So at the lower level, say, yes, you're looking more, because, again, it's more elementary, more rudimentary, not going to be as time-consuming for the parents, and also going to correct those mistakes early on. But then as you get through, especially at the end of elementary school, now you're really letting go more. And in middle school, you're not letting go of the accountability. You still want to see your child's homework, especially if a child has a difficult time as a self-starter. I mean, there are parents out there that have let their children go, and they're getting great grades, and they're natural self-starters by nature. But if you have somebody who you feel like, oh, if I let them go, they're going to fall on their face, well, that's where you just tell them, bring your work home, because kids nowadays will say, well, I didn't have any homework, or I finished my homework. Okay, great. Well, the beauty of today's technology for parents, not so much for kids, is that a lot of the homework is posted online. I know in my district, we post homework online. We post it on the Google calendar, so parents can access that at any time. And literally, they can have a child, if they want, print that up for them, or just bring them to there and say, okay, this is what you had. Let's see what you did. And then if it looks really sloppy, the parent could say, I want you to redo that nice and neat. So that could be the extent of it, but really not looking at accuracy at that point.
Okay.
That's more the teacher's job.
Gotcha. The notion that children have lots of different things that they have to deal with, you certainly address in The Ultimate Guide to Raising Teens and Tweens. You talk about things that, some things that parents know exist and others that parents would possibly be surprised to hear about. Certainly bullying, you address that issue, and you say that you yourself were bullied as a child. What do you want parents to, or adults to be aware of when it comes to children and bullying?
Yeah, well, I think bullying takes on different, multiple forms, should I say, nowadays. When I was younger, I myself, along with the millions of other children who experienced bullying in some form, it's really an ongoing pattern of harassment and abuse. So that's one thing. If the child is coming home and really has changed in some way, they're not as happy about certain things, if they're seeing grades go down, or if they're constantly saying that this child is bothering them, that's a form of abuse. And I think what the scary thing nowadays is, you have cyberbullying take place, and that's a serious problem, and that's growing among the tweens, the teens, and even college-age students, where directly this could be an in-person thing where they're laughing at them and they don't know why. I mean, and it could be, again, a lot of times it's behind the social networking websites, or it's in the chat rooms, or it's on the apps, whatever the case may be. You have these different forms going on. And what I would say with that is that's where you want to go through. You talk with the child first off, what's the problem? And then you ask them, what have you done to try to rectify the problem? And then you move into other avenues. Maybe you can talk with the parents and have a conversation about that. And then from that, if it continues to be a problem, you bring it up to the administrative level. You move it up. You know, again, for me, it was tough because I didn't really have a lot of coping mechanisms. My parents did the best they could. They stressed the importance of telling a teacher. And I did. I didn't, you know, I was not promoted to fight back with fisticuffs. And that's something I held off for a long period of time until I really had to. And that seemed to really end it. And sometimes I wish early on I had done that, but that's not the right means to go about. It's more so about trying to find a way to resolve the conflicts. And I tell the kids, I say, what you want to do, obviously, is walk away. Okay, try to avoid the bully. Or I say, get another friend or two and stack the deck in their favor. And I really promote the fact of standing up, not being a bystander, because bystanders, they can make the problem even that much worse. So those are some of the issues going on. I think what's great in our schools, we have an open sort of anonymous box policy where a kid can put in a note, and then we look at it, and then that's a good way of a child, you know, being able to express themselves. And that's what's really key, because there's so many kids out there that want to express themselves, but they feel, if I tell mom or dad, it's going to make the problem worse. If I tell a teacher, they're going to go right to the parent, and then it's like, oh, you know, you're a big baby. And I know that's always been the fear for myself and probably for many others. And I think with the cyberbullying going on, that's something that can be 24/7. So really teaching the importance of digital permanence, what you write online could stay forever. And also what you write online could be deemed for legal process in terms of being arrested. And that's one thing my administration does great. They have zero tolerance policy. If you're caught doing anything with bullying, that's deemed for being arrested, and it doesn't matter what age you are.
Interesting.
So that's today's society.
Would you say that there is a zero tolerance policy with respect to cyberbullying? Because this could be going on in the child's home. They may be fine in the school, but not so fine at home.
Yes, I would say, well, anything that is related back, if there's a child doing something at home, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, a child is being cyberbullied, but in their home or outside of the school grounds. They get the upsetting tweets or texts or something, but they're off school grounds.
Oh, no, that's still deemed for having a person being pulled into law enforcement. Yeah, the child, no matter if it's on school grounds or off school grounds, that's deemed for an arrest. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, the school develops protocol and for that. And we also have, I wouldn't say a comprehensive educational policy, but we've had in there the looking in theater to talk about the effects of bullying. And we've had law enforcement come in to talk about that in order to keep the school safe and everyone safe. So even off school grounds, if something like this happens and there's any word that any student at Henry James is bullying another student at the school, then that's deemed for being spoken with law enforcement.
You also talk about the impact of the media and violent video gaming on children. And we both know that there are so many games out there that, at least personally, I think are rather extraordinarily horrifying, but there are so many of them that the children are often clamoring, you know, Sally's got it, Joe's got it, why can't I have it, you're a terrible parent, I hate you forever, I want this game. And you know, the parents are going, but it's X-rated, it's triple R, whatever those ratings are, and the parents don't want to, but a lot of times parents will give in. What do you want parents to understand about the impact of violent video games and violent media?
Well, certainly video games by nature aren't going to cause somebody to go out and be a killer, but it's the sake of the perfect storm. If somebody is not, and again, the parents should know the psychological, mental stability of their child. and also realize that age appropriate. You know, so I'm a firm believer in video games that help build a child's dexterity, problem solving, things that are not rated so violent. And we're looking at a lot of these series. You know, I've spoken on TV about this with the Halo series, Grand Theft Auto, and I'm not trying to knock them. I think the people who made these games are very creative in terms of how realistic it is. The only problem is for a child's mind, and sometimes they don't know the difference between fact and fiction, especially really, really young children. So they take on the first-person role as the assailant, and they embody that character. And then what that could lead to is sort of a desensitization of violence toward others, where if you're watching a movie that has violence in it, all right, or you're watching a TV show, they may take on the role as the victim and say, oh, you know, how bad that was for this person, and that's not a good thing to do, or they're thinking more of a heroic, versus if you're the one firing the pistol and firing the machine gun and going after people, it's a different perspective to somebody who's a developing mind. And if that developing mind is not a self-confident, stable, coming from a family of values mentality, and that's all they're doing, I mean, that becomes an addiction, and it could be a mental obsession leading a child down a wrong path to make some very poor choices later on.
So what do parents do when they've got the child who's coming home pleading, crying, demanding, insisting that they have a game that either the parents don't know anything about because they haven't researched it, or they just want to give in because they want their child to be happy?
Well, that's where that comes down to the individual parent. But I'm a firm believer that a parent could even play the video game with the child. And when in playing together, that forms an emotional bond and forms a connection. And then the parent could see firsthand really how violent is this video game. Because, yeah, I don't expect a parent to be up on every single game, every single bit of technology, but for them to be more involved, you know, even when it comes to social media, you know, parents have asked me, well, when's the right time for my child to get on Instagram or used to be Facebook and all that? When do I give them the ability to do the Snapchat? Well, I said, well, as much as you're willing to monitor it, as much as you're willing to be involved and friend them or like them or whatever it takes to connect in with them, yes, there's going to be a time where you want to give them responsibility. You want to just say no, 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 and take away, but you want to guide them in a way to make good choices. And also, those choices could be ones that, you know, if they're playing a game, for instance, and you see their grades going down, or you suddenly see a change in their peer group, or they're becoming more antisocial, less empathetic, and all these things as warning signs, that's when you step in there and say, this is not working out. Okay, we're not going to be playing these games because this is obviously what has happened. They've made the choice to play the games. You've kind of approved it as a parent. It's not working out. Other parents may say, no way, I don't have any time for that. And then others, you know, let their child go, and their child knows, oh, I could play for an hour, and then I get to my homework, and life is good. So it's all on an individual basis.
Gotcha. So really, parents need to pay attention to their children, which one would anticipate anyway. But, you know, in today's world, whether you've got one parent or two, they're often so busy doing half a thousand different things. It's hard to pay attention. But clearly what you're describing is the value of paying attention to your child and what's going on in his or her life. Douglas, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like for you to tell us about the CALM technique. Folks, don't go away. We will continue with Douglas Haddad and the Ultimate Guide to Raising Teens and Tweens. Don't go away. Douglas, before you explain to us the CALM technique, the CALM technique, another topic that you cover in your book under child-limiting challenges is gambling. And I don't think that parents, particularly of younger children, really think about their child in terms of having a potential gambling problem. Can you speak to that issue?
Well, I think since we were talking about video games before, Dr. Brewer, I think it's important to realize that a lot of the gambling starts from the online gaming. So for kids to be involved in something like this and not have limits set upon them, all of a sudden they're playing these games, and then these games could turn into online gaming. We're seeing so much of it nowadays where I've read about these issues. I've spoken to people who say, well, I started off by, you know, just doing a little bet for $5. And then one thing leads to another, and then it goes to $100, and then they find themselves completely immersed in the thrill of winning and losing. It's all about that with the money. So that's where I see it as a bit of an issue, and it could start really young in the tween zone. And I think it's, you know, for many gamblers, it's not even about making the money. It's also about that excitement and that stimulus, that adrenaline rush of actually playing. And that's where I think, you know, some teens, they gamble out of that curiosity, and some kids are just bored or lonely, and again, it puts them in that sort of isolated zone where they can escape their problems, and then it could lend to these kind of addictions.
Yeah, you've just said that it can start in the tween zone, but you've also said that the tween zone can be considered as early as 8 years old on up through 11 or 12. So are you saying that there are some maybe even 7 or 8 or 9 year olds who are addicted to gambling?
I would say there definitely could be addicted to technology in some form, which can lead to that. Okay. I mean, I don't know how many kids can get their hands on or have that knowledge of how to access different things with credit cards and debit cards, but certainly there are kids that are very, very precocious that can do that as they get older. But I think that addiction can start as early as 7, 8, 9 years old. And especially studies have shown, too, an association between, you know, different types and frequency of video game play and gambling-related problems. And that usually stems from different family, it could be peer, social influences, sometimes even a child's personality, the values of their upbringing. That usually explains why some tweens and teens experience these different gambling-related problems.
Okay, so now that I'm feeling a little anxious about my 7 or 8 year old who might have a gambling problem, talk to me about the CALM technique.
Oh, yeah. Now I got to get you CALM, right?
Yes, please do.
Well, the CALM technique's interesting because we were talking before about video gaming and even a child that refuses, oh, I want to keep playing video games, oh, I want this game, or they're just continue to have a problem, sort of problematic behavior. Well, the CALM technique, as I've named it, is used to reduce or eliminate problem behavior in a calming manner. And it can work for really any problem, and I've seen it happen. So the CALM, the C stands for communicate. And that's the big thing right there. So really for a parent to be very clear on what expectations they have set regarding their child's behavior and also the consequences if they aren't followed. So I think really that's the key right there, clear communication and then consequences and commitment to upholding those expectations no matter what. That's really the essential part of effective parenting. So again, we talked about video games. The clear communication is you can play video games when your homework is done, satisfactory, you've completed it, as I would approve it, you can play then for 1 hour. And then you've communicated that. And then after that, then at that point, you're going to bed. Or if you don't want to, I actually wouldn't recommend it that close near bedtime. So some parents may actually say, well, you can play, you do some homework, you could take a break, you could play an hour, then do some homework. So you make it clear on that. Now, if it becomes so problematic, the A in CALM is now you avoid. So if your child tries to engage in saying, no, I want to play longer, I want to do this, now you avoid, okay, the situation. And if your child tries to argue with you in any certain way, throw temper tantrums, all this stuff, just again, back away, all right, because he may not get his way, and that's completely fine, but he's going to learn. So just give him a verbal reprimand of the expectation and then leave the room, as long as, again, it's not going to be some safety issue. Now, the L is once the child has calmed down and they've made their choice at that point, that's the key thing, they've made their choice, then you listen. That's where active listening comes in. And you just focus your complete attention on what they did. And this is when they've calmed down. You don't want to do this when they're upset, because that will just fuel the fire even more. So you can say things like, well, I feel and I hear from what you're saying, you may be very angry and frustrated and upset right now, thinking it's unfair that you weren't allowed to do this. Or you were in the middle of your favorite show and you really wanted to watch more of it. But we've talked about this before. So then you restate what the rule is. You know, you've acknowledged their feelings and emotions, so they feel that what they say is important. But also now you can initiate some conversation by saying something like, you know, it seems like you were upset about whatever it is, you know, not being able to watch the rest of your favorite show, or not being able to play the video game or longer, not being able to go over your friend's house this weekend. And then after that, then they realize, okay, what the consequence is. So therefore, now that you've broken this rule, you're not going to be able to do this the next time. However, the M is you mend it. So you have to mend it. You don't want to just leave it in a way where the child's still upset. You want to have that open, honest conversation. They realize what they did. Refrain from laying any blame or using any sarcasm or criticism when speaking with the child. And really acknowledge that it was their choice and their behavior. And then ask them, what should they have done? And then have them state it out. Okay, so you know what you should have done. What will you do next time? Oh, I'm going to next time. I'm going to make sure that I play the video game and stop when I'm supposed to hear and get back to my homework. And do you realize why that's important? Have them do a brief explanation. So really putting it on them. That's the calm technique. Communicate, avoid, all right, the situation when it gets a little, you know, heated. Then once the smoke clears, then you listen to them. And then you follow it up with the appropriate consequence that you stated early on. And then after that, M is mend. Then you mend the relationship and allow them to know that that's the choices they made. These are the consequences. But next time, you're going to make these choices, and here's the reasons for it, and let the child actually explain it. That's the key right there. And that solves most problems 99% of the time.
The calm technique. Okay. You've been talking about parents really guiding, listening, guiding, providing a safe space, if you will, for their children. You also say that the parent needs to be the boss by sharing power with their child. I'm not sure that that's something that a parent would understand. If they're the boss, they're the boss. You know, it goes back to do what I say. I told you to do it. Now go do it. I'm the boss. But you're saying share the power.
Yeah, see, children want to be heard. They want to be understood, but they also want rules, whether they say it or not. So by sharing the power, what I mean is by providing your child with certain choices. So again, if a child, say, wants, we'll just go to that video game example because that's a popular one. If a child says, I really, really want to play the video game today, say, okay, well, you have a choice. Do you want to first work on your homework and then be allowed to play video games for an hour? Or would you like to come right home, sort of decompress, you know, maybe have a snack, play video games for an hour, and then work on homework? It's your choice. However, you have to realize this is a school night. So I'm going to give you an hour to decompress, have fun, play your video game, but you also need to complete your homework assignment. That's part of being your responsibility and your job as my child and as a student. So you've given them a choice, and whether they like it or not, in both those choices, they have to do the homework, but they're also allowed, you know, again, some freedom to play a video game, as long as that's not impacting them in any way that the parent feels to their discretion that's adverse. So that's what I mean by sharing the power. It could be anything. It could be we're looking at, say, what's going to be for dinner maybe one night a week. You know, they may say, well, I don't want to eat this. Well, I don't like this. I don't like this. Well, again, sharing the power is saying, well, this is what we're going to be eating during the week. However, you're going to have an opportunity on, say, Friday night to choose from what you'd like. So what choice would you like? Would you like this or this or this? So then all of a sudden I say, well, okay, I want pizza on Friday. All right, okay, sounds good. But tonight, then they start yelling again. But tonight I really don't like to eat these, you know, whatever, pork chops. That's one thing I never really liked, is pork chops. Then we'll say, well, this is what we're going to go to the store, and next week, so then now all of a sudden you bring it to next week. Next week, you'll have an option to pick something different from pork chops. This week, we're having pork chops on Monday night. If you come to this, or when you come to the store, I'm hoping a lot of kids still go with their parents to the store shopping. Then we'll have another choice, and then the parent provides the choice, and the child gets to pick. So that's the way of using, in a positive way, psychology of choice in sharing the power with your child. It's going to work benefits and open up lines of communication big time.
You know, you just said that you hope that the children still go to the store with their parents to shop. And there are so many things that they can learn. And, you know, I think it's a fine line, though. You know, you don't want your child to say, I can buy anything I want because mom is here. On the other hand, you don't want the child so involved in, well, this costs $1.95 and this costs $1.98, and then getting anxious about just what the finances are. So it really is, it's a fine line. Parenting is not for the weak of heart, that's for sure.
Oh, no. And it's, you know, it's one of the most rewarding, if not the most rewarding job on the planet. But it could be for a while during this tween and teen zone, one of the most thankless jobs. So the key is to, I think, with anything in life, and whether it's children, whether it's adults, why we see problems manifest in humanity is because people are not understood, they don't feel loved, they feel judged, and with all of that, if we can turn the tide and find any way to connect with a child by showing that you care, showing that they're loved, okay, through actual action, not by buying them this, buying them that. Like you said, don't get used to that, playing good cop, bad cop with parents, being on the same page, loving a child, and also listening to them and not judging them, but rather, how did I word this? I was thinking, I said this to a parent one time. I said, you want to listen to understand, not listen to reprimand. And children know. Children know, oh boy, you know, are they going to, am I going to say something and hear a big lecture on it? Are they going to, you know, judge me on this? Or are they going to listen to me if I tell them something to understand in an empowering way? Kids are real smart. They're smarter than we realize sometimes.
And I think it makes us nervous sometimes when we realize how smart children really are. You talk about using child unlimited tools on a daily basis. Is this another long list of things that a parent has to be aware of?
Well, I'll tell you right now, these are the core principles that without these, a child cannot become a 3S child. I'll put it to you that way. And really what we've talked about today, Dr. Brewer, everything from how to set appropriate limits. And that's why I call this child unlimited tools, because if we allow a child to be unlimited in anything they can see, anything they can do, anything they can touch, anything they can read, and in all capacities, then that's going to limit them in the future. Because let's say, oh, well, I don't want to do homework. I'm unlimited in terms of I can go out and explore. I don't have any rules. Well, guess what? When they get to the real world and they suddenly have to encounter rules from their boss, that's going to limit them if they're not able to read, write, communicate, because they didn't want to when they were younger. So my Child Unlimited Tools starts off in Chapter 1 by talking about setting the appropriate limits so they can be unlimited in their full potential, talking about how to go back to what it was like when parents were their children's age and what are the different things that these children think about. I pose all these questions to try to connect with a child early on. We talked about being the boss by sharing power with your child, how to do that, effective parenting techniques for what's the best, most positive approach to parenting versus just punishing and disciplining that way. Also, how to motivate your child, I talk about in the Child Unlimited Tools. That's a big one. How to then hold accountability on your child and grow them into leaders. I think we need more leaders in the world. Leadership is paramount to success. And then ultimately, how to set goals. And I talk about this. I talk about how to help your child achieve the goal by ready, set, grow. That's really the play on words right there, because that's what it's all about. We want them to set their own goals and become problem solvers and be able to effectively communicate and develop resiliency skills when times get tough. Because in the end, it's not so much about what you teach them. It's about what you teach them for them to become self-sufficient, independent. And that's what's really important for their success.
Douglas Haddad, author of The Ultimate Guide to Raising Teens and Tweens, Strategies for Unlocking Your Child's Full Potential. Douglas, tell me there's a website that parents can go to for more information.
Oh, absolutely. You can go to my website. It's my name, Douglas Haddad, HADDAD.com. You can find out all kinds of information. I actually write a couple blogs. I write The Whole Child and The Well Parent. So anything for your child would be under, obviously, The Whole Child. And anything and everything for parents on there as well. I actually have a free 25-page guide. It's called The Whole Lot of Living Guide. Everything from healthy home, ways to eliminate stress from daily, day-to-day living, eating strategies, moving more, sleeping better, thinking well, and all that. And I also have a unique program on there as well, an audio program, 30 Days to Finding You and Start Living the Life You Imagine. That's all on my website.
That sounds terrific. And again, that's DouglasHaddad.com. Douglas, thank you so much for joining us today here on Mind Talk and giving us lots of good information, lots of things to think about. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is available to you daily at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast by going to iTunes. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes store and also from the Google Play Store. And the apps are at no charge. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.